a full-time job.
Wow.
But it's been interesting.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Especially in, now that I'm getting down to the point where I think I can finally start writing the history.
Uh-huh.
To getting different viewpoints on things and stuff that I didn't know. And I think I've interviewed over 40 people now.
Is that right?
A couple of times. And so I'm way behind on transcribing those, but on putting the pictures up, there are over 6,000 of them up now. Another 1,000 in the process. So.
And then you're going to, what, publish a book or something?
The history of the, what I want to do is write a history of the community. Uh-huh. It started out just the church, but had discovered that for a small congregation, they had their fingers in all kinds of missions and things that affected it. So it's kind of got a little bit bigger now to bring some of that stuff in. Which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you. One, to get your story, and second, to hear some of the history that affects, especially some of the aspects I'm looking at that you were involved in. Were your folks living next door when you were born? Or?
They moved in there when I was 5 years old. We lived, actually I was born in Ned Buckwalter's house there on Wanger Road.
Oh, they lived
there? They lived there when they were first married. Well, I say, they actually lived, remember the little white house beside Olin years ago?
Yeah.
William Sawyer's wife's parents lived there. But before that, when Mom and Dad got married, they lived there.
And before then, the Culpeppers lived there.
Okay, there's been a number of families there over the years.
The story I heard was that Clarence built it because the Culpeppers were his relatives, his wife's relatives.
Okay.
King descendants.
Okay.
And Carrie was a king.
So, my parents didn't live there long after from Nettie's house to there. And then they built that house that your Uncle Carson had across the road. And they moved back here from there when I was 5 years old.
Okay. One of my first memories is standing there and thinking Carolyn was awfully cute when they were doing the bricks. We were probably 5 years old. Because it was up for just tar paper for a while, wasn't it?
The what?
Didn't he build a house and y'all lived there for a while before they put the brick on?
Oh, here?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it was about two. Yeah, they did it in stages.
Mm-hmm.
Grandpa Miller built the house, so you can imagine how long that took. So they built the house, and then they covered it with tar paper felt,
mm-hmm.
and it sat like that for, I don't know, maybe 2 years or something like that. And then Harold Buckwalter and Abe put the brick on it.
Mm.
It wasn't real long, but we actually moved in there before it was finished downstairs, and we lived upstairs for about 6 months.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Carol and I still talk about having to take the little red pitcher downstairs to get water to bring it upstairs. That would certainly be a no-no today. You'd have
no. You could do a lot of things then you couldn't do now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But what's your earliest memory? What's your first memory?
Yeah, I would say probably living down in that house that Carson then bought for mm-hmm. my parents, and just playing outside. I remember Ernest had the farm across the field from us,
mm-hmm.
diagonally across the field, and he had heifers, cattle he was milking at that time, and I remember the heifers being out there in the field, and then us kids would go over there, and then you know how cows are. They get inquisitive and they mm-hmm. run towards you. We think we were being attacked. But also, Carol Herring lived backed up to us. So we were back and forth. It was just across the field. It was just about as far as from here to Mom and Dad's house,
okay,
from their back door.
The house that was later the Gregory's house?
The one, not Schwartz's house.
The one next to it.
The one next to it.
Okay, yeah, that was later the Gregory house.
Yeah, okay. So we were back and forth. Of course, say, we were, I would have been pretty young then. Yeah. Carol and I both would have been pretty young, but we were, I mean, we're old enough to remember that and everything. And he had a brother, Jonathan, that was killed doing bulldozer work.
What happened?
Did a tree fall?
A tree or tree limb or something. He was pushing stuff with a bulldozer.
Yeah, Carol's a source of some community history.
Yeah.
From time to time. Let's see, they already built a new school when you started school. So, but they just had the two rooms then, right?
Yeah. I didn't attend the school there at the end of Carter Road.
That was already gone by then.
Yeah, that was, they had already moved up to where it is now.
When you were drafted, the guys before you, a lot of them went to Williamsburg, and then Philip and Ed and some others went to Cleveland.
Uh-huh.
You went to Columbus, right?
I went to Columbus.
How come Columbus rather than
Olin, I went up there with Olin, and Kenny Kurtz also went to Columbus. And I'm not sure exactly how it all happened, but Jerry Kephart also went to Columbus. So the three of us were there at the same time, or very close to the same time.
I didn't realize that he had gone into one of these circles, because I guess I was probably gone about the same time. And just how did you meet Linda then?
Well, I was through that and going with Olin. Olin had relatives in Columbus, in Plain City, and he was going back and forth. He was actually in Cleveland.
Right, that's what I knew he was.
But he would come down to Columbus.
Okay.
And then he would come down here, and I went a couple of times with him. He'd say, "Do you want to go to Plain City with me?" Oh, yeah, I was at EMC at that time, and during holidays, and Christmas break and things like that. So that's when I met Linda.
What did you do in Montgomery?
I was operating room orderly. And it was I still think that was one of the best things that happened to me. I mean, because it was at Ohio State, and Ohio State is, of course, Ohio State Hospital is a teaching hospital. So they got all of the worst cases from all over the state of Ohio. They had 14 operating rooms in there, and they would average, I would say they probably averaged 3 to 4 operations a day in each room.
And you were in the rooms with the operations?
I was in the rooms, in and out. I couldn't get right up at the table, but I could get close enough to see a lot of the things, brain surgery and heart surgery and all of that stuff. And that was at the beginning of bypass surgery. In fact, they did the first triple bypass operation there at Ohio State while I was there. But unfortunately, the gentleman didn't make it but about 3 days, and he passed away. But I can still see that heart and lung machine down on the floor, and it's got two cylinders going like that, and as they turn, it would pump the blood while they were operating.
That would have been fast. I was at my OMW was in Richmond at MCD, which was also a teaching hospital, but I was in the business office, so I didn't get to see much interesting.
What you did was probably a little more practical for life than what I did.
Well, what I did was, I was a collection guy, so I sued people who owed the hospital money and went to court. That's all I did.
Is that right?
And there were, just like your hospital as as a state institution, it got all the poor people who couldn't pay for it.
Yeah.
And probably 70% of them were pregnancies by young ladies who were not married and couldn't pay the bill. And then we'd sue their parents, and it was just saved a lot of ladies. In fact, I did a thing up there that I shouldn't have done at the time, but one of the people we sued without knowing it was Gladys Laura Schattinger.
Uh-huh.
And her husband, I'll bring her to something. And she came in, and and I wanted to make a deal to make small payments because they were farmers, not making any money, poor, just, you know, kind of desperate. So we had a fund we could apply to for relief, and my partner and I, who had the other half of the alphabet, wore that thing out in about a month, a whole year's budget, so there wasn't any left there. So I told her, well, don't worry about it. And I got a hold of all the records and destroyed them. She no longer wrote the hospital.
Wow.
I just, oh, that was really, I shouldn't have done that. Someone's going to catch me. But it was before the days of computers. I mean, we had one, but it didn't do much. And so I said, well, all these other people aren't paying the hospital. There's no point in dragging down some good people who are just having a hard time here. So anyway. And when you got back, did y'all ever consider living in Ohio, or would you plan to come back here?
Well, we planned to come back here. Yeah, I stayed for a year after we were married. Well, let's see. Yeah, about a year after we were married, I continued. While I was finishing up my 1W, I was looking for something for career, something to do, and I looked into computers, took a course at ECPI, and got a job with Nationwide Insurance, their headquarters, world headquarters or main headquarters, whatever, is in Columbus, and I got a job there, and I was a computer operator for about 2 years. And then that's when we moved back down here.
Okay, so you all stayed there a couple years after your 1W service.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't realize.
Yeah, it wasn't real long. It was like maybe 3.5 years or something like that, that I was up there. Yeah.
And then when you got down here, you went to work with, was it Smith Douglas?
No, my first job was with the Colonial Stores at Ingleside. That long warehouse there on the, right there on the corner. I don't know what it is now. It was Colonial Stores grocery warehouse. So I was doing the same thing, a computer operator there. And then I wasn't there very long, and I was looking for something else. And I Nationwide had NCR computers. And there was a NCR branch there on Virginia Beach Boulevard.
I remember it.
And so I went there, and they couldn't believe that somebody, because NCR wasn't, IBM was the big.
Right.
And I couldn't believe that somebody came in that had some operating experience. So I was kind of hired on the spot. So I worked there for 5-6 years, I guess, something like that, as a computer operator. And we had a room full of computers that didn't have as much power as that does. But
now, when y'all had moved back down here and settled in, how did you make the transition from just being a member of the laity and a member at Mount Pleasant to moving into the ministry? What was the process there? What happened?
It was about 78, 79. I kind of made a rededication to the Lord. And Jane Berger came to me one night at church and wanted to know if I would go to the jail, wanted to go along to the jail with them. So I said, yeah, I'll go along. So I went, thinking it would be a 1, 2, or 3-time event, and it ended up being 12 years
okay.
that I went to the jail every Sunday morning from all through the 80s.
So that was your first step into the ministry?
That was the first step into the ministry.
I just posted a picture of you and Minna Yoder standing outside the jail.
Yeah. Minna, and early on it was Francis. Francis Miller, and James, myself, well, Jerry Silsby for a while, a few others off and on, but Manna and James were the two main ones. And then late 80s, 89, I was put up for deacon at Mount Pleasant. And I served as a deacon for 2 years. And that was when Phil and Robert were going through their transition. Phil was transitioning. Robert was still pretty much involved, very much. Mm-hmm. But you know Robert, he's always planning out ahead of time. and Phil was kind of moving off. So that's when, so Adona Nisley came in. They brought Adona Nisley in. And Harold Berge was assistant pastor.
Okay. Now, this is when Phil first started having his mental decline?
No, Phil didn't have his mental problems until like my years or
maybe. Yeah, it is.
98, 99.
Okay.
It was quite a bit later, but he was retiring.
Okay, slowly moving out of the
mental. Yeah. And Harold came on, and they felt like they needed someone else. I'm trying to think where Robert was at that time.
He had a mental breakdown at one point.
Well, he did. All I remember now is that Harold was brought on as assistant.
Right.
And I guess Robert wanted time off or time away or whatever. So that's when they brought Adona in. They mm-hmm. brought somebody in for a year. I was still a deacon at that time. Well, it was in 91 then that Adona was going back. Harold was brought on as the lead pastor. And then I came on as assistant pastor at that time.
Okay.
And then I served about 6 years at Mount Pleasant as an assistant, along with Harold.
How tough was that to be a pastor in a church you grew up in and knew everybody? Well, was it an advantage or a disadvantage?
That's a good question. Because I've experienced it both ways, later on in Lambstown and everything. I think it was probably good to begin with. Mm-hmm. It was nice knowing everybody in the congregation. I don't see it as being particularly difficult. Mm. Of course, I wasn't the lead pastor either. It was kind of what I was used to because I had been attending there since I was born.
After the 6 years, where did you go then? To Lansdowne?
No, actually. Actually, Daniel Berge and I wanted to do a church plant.
Okay. Was this just from you all, or was the Mennonite? I've gotten some inklings in some folks I've talked to that the Virginia Conference was very much pushing church plants in this period.
Well, they were, but I felt like I wanted to reach out beyond the church that I had grown up in.
Okay.
And I had a heart for particularly down and out people. Daniel had just graduated from Bible school in Harrisonburg, Cornerstone.
Okay.
He went to Cornerstone.
And let me ask another question, just a little bit off topic here. How much influence do you think Cornerstone had on the Mennonite Conference getting or begin to push planting new churches? I mean, they had been successful when typically the Mennonite experience was we lose members, we don't gain.
Yeah.
We gain them when the Amish trickle down.
Yeah. It's a little hard for me to say. Cornerstone and Virginia Conference were in Harrisonburg.
Right.
And I know there was some friction, yeah, Virginia Conference had a lot of missionaries, so they were not opposed to reaching out. I think probably Cornerstone for some of the Virginia Conference people was a little bit too charismatic. There was a little tension there, but they were supportive of church plants and mission work and that type of thing.
So you and
Daniel.
Daniel. You had the church sanction for this, or you all just decided?
Well, we did. Robert's always supportive of me, and was an encourager. I've told people in the past, I wouldn't say that Mount Pleasant really got behind us. They grudgingly gave their approval. It's kind of what it was. Mm-hmm. But James and Mary were also a part of that. So that gave us a little credibility mm-hmm. too with the older people and the Kale, Bob and Alice. You remember Bob Kale? He was real good friends with Daniel.
No, that was that period from about 78 to 2005 or so.
Yeah,
we were Methodists, so.
Oh, okay.
I didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah, okay.
Internally at the church.
Yeah. Anyway, so that sort of made up the core mm-hmm. of the church plant. Also, Darlene Miller, Eugene Miller, that would be... Roy's oldest son.
Yeah, okay. I remember Eugene
and
Darlene.
But he got into a lot of trouble. And they were separated. He and Darlene were separated, but they had, oh gracious, how many did they have? Six maybe kids, and they were all through that. The youngest was about four maybe, and the oldest was a mid-teenager. So they had all these kids that needed a lot of attention. So they were part of it too for quite a while.
Mm.
But of course, they were, James and Mary were uncle and aunt
right.
to them.
So how did that work? Did you all, because I'm not familiar, I just know that there was a separate church, or Daniel, I didn't realize you were involved with it.
Yeah.
I knew that Daniel had started a church.
Yeah.
But so what happened? Where'd you meet?
All right, okay. Well, we did it for about 2 years, and we had a lot of good ministry and things. We rented a school up here for a while. There again, they grudgingly rented it to us, and so we met there, and then we met. I was involved with pastors' groups here in Great Bridge and so on,
mm-hmm.
and the Lutheran Church got to be real good friends, John Dudley. He was a pastor at the Lutheran Church right behind, you know where Mr. Jim's is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go up Johnstown Road and right off to the right, immediately off to the right, there's a Lutheran church mm-hmm. there. And so we met there for maybe a year or so. So we met a couple different places.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, what happened was that we weren't seeing much growth or anything and everything. Of course, I was friends with Dave Zook from over in Lambstown, and I knew a couple of other people from over there, the elder group over there. I knew them, Jim Sutherland and Stan Jeter, and they kind of got word of what we were doing and so on, and they're very mission-minded and everything, and they said, hey, why don't you come on to Lambstown, bring your group to Lambstown, and sort of come in here, and then after a year or two, we'll send you back out, try to plant a church from out of Lambstown. And at that point, I was starting to get a little bit burned out, kind of felt like we're kind of treading water, and I thought it was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel did too at first, and we went over there for a Sunday or two, and pretty soon Daniel started backing up, because Daniel, I know all along he had visions of having his own church and everything, and it became pretty obvious that he was starting to pull back and didn't really want to mm-hmm. Continue on. So then at that point, when I realized that, then I said, look, I said, why don't we just, Linda and I are just going to go over to Lambstown. We're going to, we feel like that was a real opportunity, but if you want to continue on with Dove Fellowship, you have our blessings, just, you know, go ahead. James and Mary were still there and others and so on. So that's what they did. And it ended up being a blessing for both us and Daniel. Mm-hmm. Because Daniel soon got connected with the New Life Church, and he ended up getting a church down at Moyock, where he's been for, 20 years now. Right.
So what happened to the Dove congregation? They just melted into one.
Yeah, then finally, Daniel and James and Mary, and they kept it going for maybe 6 months or so. And then they decided, I don't know quite what the process was with them, but they got connected with New Life. Mm-hmm. And, then we withdrew our, withdrew, I guess that's from Virginia Conference. We didn't withdraw from the conference. We just told them that we were no longer functioning. Okay.
This is the Dove Fellowship.
Dove Fellowship. We were no longer, we went through the process because they had commissioned us.
Right.
Virginia Conference had commissioned us. So we were really disbanding Dove Fellowship, right, was what it amounted to. And that was kind of the end of that. But then I went to, Linda and I were going to Lambstown.
Right.
And we weren't there but a month or two. And see, that was when Sam, Noah Stossfuss, he was the pastor there.
Okay, first was Harold, right?
Yes.
How come they asked Harold to leave there?
You know, that's a touchy.
I know it's very touchy.
Yeah, and I don't know. I think the congregation, nearest I can understand, is that they felt like the church wasn't going to grow. They needed new leadership.
Okay.
It wasn't going to grow under Harold's leadership.
And so this came actually more from the will of the congregation than from somewhere on high.
Yeah. 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 It came from the, and that was, I think that was what was so hurtful to Harold Twala, was the fact that it came, well, see, that was at the same time. See, Phil was very much involved with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was giving counsel to these others, and he was a part of Harold being moved on, right, and that caused real heartburn for Harold and Twala, that they kind of felt like they had been undercut.
One of the stories that I haven't heard this story, just something I seem to remember, is that when Harold went through this and then went to work for Dave Zucker and then decided, no, he's going back to the sea ministry, that there were men in the congregation, including your dad and mine, who privately supported Harold.
Yeah.
Did that happen? Or my memory?
No, I think that's correct. I mean, I know my parents, they couldn't understand. We didn't talk about it
right,
much, but the little that I did, or they couldn't understand Phil's motivation in moving Harold out of that position. And I'm sure your dad was probably the same way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of. But at the same time, he knew that, I remember him talking to Mama once or twice, that he thought Harold was mismatched. It didn't fit his talents, that he was not an evangelizing, outgoing, dynamic,
yeah,
type person. And he thought that the sea mission was probably more of his low-key,
yeah,
one-on-one,
yeah,
talents and gifts than,
yeah,
being a dynamic leader. Now, when he left, did they offer it to Sam immediately?
No. So they brought in Noah Stossfuss.
Okay, did he come through Cornerstone too?
No.
He was from Virginia.
He was from New York, and I'm not sure how they got in touch with him, but I do know. I think when they were talking about bringing someone else in, that they wanted to bring someone in younger and more. Well, a younger person, and that was another thing. I can hear my mom saying when she saw Noah, uh-huh. Well, he's not any younger than Harold is.
But I talked to Sam at length about this, and he claims that, you know, while he was going to school, he and Harold were constantly in touch, and that their plans were that when he graduated or finished, he was going to come back here and be Harold's assistant, which probably might not have been a bad idea because he's, you know, the dynamic evangelistic gift.
Right, right.
But they neglected to tell anybody, and nobody knew it except them. It was their plan. They didn't discuss it with anybody else. They didn't ask if it was feasible. They just didn't do it. And then when Harold was dismissed, Sam said they came to him to ask him, and he said, I can't do it. The family dynamics, you know.
Oh, this
will not work. You
no,
know.
No, yeah.
Can't do it. And so he stayed up with Cornerstone.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it, but that makes sense. But anyway, Noah came down and was, I don't know how long Noah was here. Maybe 10 years. He was here for quite a while, maybe 10 years or so. And then they were having, I don't know all the dynamics that were going on over there at the time, but they were having a lot of problems. And Noah left, you know, or they asked him to leave. I don't know all the dynamics, but that's when Sam came on.
Okay.
That was after Noah, and they didn't have a pastor, have anybody in mind. The elders were holding the church together.
Okay, that fits what Dave said.
Yeah. But along about that time, Sam was moving back to the area.
Right.
So they approached Sam. And they actually, I remember the night that he was voted in. Sam and Beverly were there, and they asked them to step out. And there was just a pent up, they really wanted a pastor, and they didn't know where one was going to come from. But it was unanimous when they stepped out and they voted. It was unanimous. I mean, there was just a big applause, and I remember now, just like a release. Mm-hmm. We've got our pastor now. But you know how Sam is. You know, he's here one day and he's over here another day. You know. Anyway, he started out, and right soon after, he was making a lot of changes in the congregation and everything, and for the good. But there was a number of families, some families that left and so on. But